Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast, the home for conversations with global leaders in the trade show and events business. Our show will bring you face to face with experts who speak about the possibilities and trajectories of this $50 billion industry. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make conversion easy. Welcome to this episode of the Trade Show Podcast. Thank you for listening and your continued feedback. If you have suggestions or you want me to dig in with a specific guest, please write to me at shubhanjan@pitch.link or message me on LinkedIn. Both links available in the show notes. I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Dr. Corey C. Miller, a seasoned educator, researcher, and speaker on Generation Z. She led the Global Gen Z study, where she worked with 91 researchers from around the globe to better understand cultural differences among Gen Z.
I work at a college. I've worked at colleges and universities most of my career, and I've always had a pulse on the students who come in. They're the best way to figure out kind of who the new adults are coming into the world. And I just started noticing that they were really different. They were asking lots of different questions, things like, they were trying to find out more about how to get involved in their communities, how to create social change, how to connect with their passions. It was a very values-driven kind of group of people that I kept seeing. And it doesn't mean that the people that came before them, like me, aren't values-driven, but it seemed to be so on the forefront of their identities that I thought something is really different here. We're at the precipice of something really unique, because most people had been talking about this generation as just, you know, tech, right? They swipe and they do social media and they're on their devices. And that's kind of what everybody was focusing on. And it was like, wait a minute, there's a lot more to them than just this idea that they're just constantly on their phones.
Dr. Corey C. Miller is a seasoned educator, researcher, and speaker on Gen Z. Her work has been featured on NPR and in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, Popular Science, USA Today, Business Insider, and the Chronicle of Higher Education, as well as in several other news publications and cited in nearly 5,000 academic articles and books. She has engaged in market research consulting for Fortune 10, 50, and 500 companies. With now more than a 250,000 views, her TED Talk on Generation Z at TEDx Dayton showcased how Generation Z plans to make a difference in the world. Corey led Global Gen Z study, where she worked with 91 researchers from around the globe to better understand cultural differences among Gen Z. More than 30,000 participants from 81 countries took part in the study, making it one of the largest Gen Z studies ever conducted. She recently completed her fifth study, Generations in the World of Work, and her book by the same name was released from Routledge Publishing. She is also the author of the books Generation Z Goes to College, Generation Z Leads, Generation Z A Century in Making, Generation Z Learns, and Gen Z Around the World. Dr. C. Miller received her bachelor's degree in communication, master's degree in educational leadership, and PhD in higher education. She serves as a professor in the Department of Leadership Studies in Education and Organizations at Wright State University. Now, on to this insightful episode with Dr. Corey C. Miller. Corey, welcome to the Trade Show Podcast. I'm delighted to have you here. Because I was seriously looking forward to this conversation since I had the conversation with David. And he was like, you must talk to her because she really knows what's going on with Gen Z. And so much is on them. They're in the buying position. They're in the leadership position. So things have really got to be looked at differently. And it can't be what we have been doing in the past. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Let's start with your TEDx talk and where you sort of elaborate on how you started looking at it, I guess, at Gen Z and found them they're really different from what we were and what we were looking at earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. I mean, I work at a college. I've worked at colleges and universities most of my career, and I've always had a pulse on the students who come in. They're the best way to figure out kind of who the new adults are coming into the world. And I just started noticing that they were really different. They were asking lots of different questions, things like, they were trying to find out more about how to get involved in their communities, how to create social change, how to connect with their passions. It was a very values-driven kind of group of people that I kept seeing. And it doesn't mean that the people that came before them, like me, aren't values driven, but it seemed to be so on the forefront of their identities that I thought something is really different here. We're at the precipice of something really unique, because most people had been talking about this generation as just, you know, tech, right? They swipe and they do social media and they're on their devices. And that's kind of what everybody was focusing on. And it was like, wait a minute, there's a lot more to them than just this idea that they're just constantly on their phones. There's more depth. They want connection. They want meaning. They want value and they want purpose. And so I could see that as they were coming into the college setting.
Right. I totally agree. In fact, that's one of the points we had discussed with David, that they have been rubbished a lot by people who are supposedly experts. And I don't know to name anybody. I think you know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Who are the people we're talking about. And I thought that we're taking a very surface level, very generic kind of quick to conclusion approach to an entire generation.
Right.
Like exactly what he said, that they're in their phones, they don't want to connect, they sit in the same room but talk to each other on text, as if fundamentally, that's something wrong,
right?
Because we didn't do it.
Right. And that's the funny thing is we didn't do it at their age, but if we had phones that are at their age, we would have done it, right? That's the thing I think is so funny, because as older adults, we do that too.
Yes.
But we just think back to when we were their age and we're like, we didn't do that. And so it's easy to just be kind of what I call a generational pessimist, to see, you know, kids these days and, you know, kind of roll your eyes or get frustrated. But the reality is that there's so much more depth to this generation than I think they're given credit for.
I also want to clarify, this is a thought, and I want to ask, the fundamental difference is that up to our generation, we sort of were very close to our parents' generation, we like it or not. Our lifestyle was not significantly different from them. And we sort of thought it's the same thing with our children, which means their lifestyle and their life is not significantly different from us. And that's why we believe that they are, you know, this flaky, without any concentration, ability to see. They're the 22nd generation. You can't, they can't focus on anything more than whatever, 2 minutes or whatever is the social media number these days, right?
Right.
Do you see, I mean, it's kind of that kind of thought process in play, or is it something else?
I mean, part of it is, it's interesting because, you know, I've read some takes where people say that I'm Generation X, that we have more in common with our grandparents than we have with our children when it comes to certain parts of, you know, societal expectations, technology use, those things. Like the way that I grew up playing outside is very much the way that my grandparents grew up playing outside. Today, it's very different. And so we, you know, particularly parents of Gen Zers who are not exclusively, but primarily Gen X, we sort of live in like this toggled world where we remember our childhoods very differently than what our kids' childhoods are today. Yet today, in this moment, we are living in a lifestyle that is very similar to our kids' lifestyle. It's just that our ages are different. So it's kind of, you know, your brain gets kind of turned around with that. Because I think, you know, again, when I was younger, we'd just go out and play until the, you know, the streetlights came on and I drank out of a garden hose when I was thirsty. And like, you know, no, your parents didn't know where you were. That wouldn't be the case today. But the fact is that like, you know, I live a very similar lifestyle to my daughter. We're on our phones. We're streaming movies. We're doing all the same things. It's just our histories are different.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Let's delve into this, the world of events and trade shows. So when you look at them, how do you think they are relating to this whole in-person ecosystem? And do you think it is different from how we look at it?
Well, you know, what's interesting about, you know, Gen Z, again, when we talk about the surface level, people you know, have been thinking since they were very young, you know, the oldest of them, that, you know, they don't want to connect. They don't like face to face. They want to be on their phones. And that's just patently untrue. You know, they enjoy that, but they also really, really prefer face to face connection and face to face communication. And when I've been studying this since pre-COVID, my first study was in 2014. And then I studied it sort of in the midst of sort of after the height of COVID in 21 and 22 and found that those measures are really the same. And there's a real desire for this generation to connect. And they like the face-to-face communication. The big point, though, is not so much that they like it, it's that whether they feel confident in doing it. So even before COVID, there was just a lack of confidence and competence with this generation in being able to connect face-to-face. They said, I don't know how to make small talk. I don't know how to have conversations. I don't know how to network. I don't know how to turn to the person next to me in class and introduce myself. And and there's a lot of reasons, a lot of societal reasons why that happened, particularly with education systems kind of transitioning to more preparation for standardized testing and moving away from a lot of those very interpersonal classes and lack of, you know, we even saw in schools where, you know, kids would go out at recess and recess was getting shortened and shortened and shortened to the point where that's where the kids interact. That's where they learn those social skills and there's less of it. So when they become adults, we're kind of saying, wait a minute, I don't understand how you don't know how to just like go up to a table and introduce yourself to someone. And so we saw that pre-COVID. And of course, we know COVID set pretty much everybody back when it came to that. We just sort of were on a standstill. And so we're still, you know, kind of dealing with the aftermath of that. But it was happening before COVID too. And a lot of people just kind of think that COVID was the cause. But we have a generation of young people that really didn't get a lot of practice and didn't get a lot of skill set development in interpersonal skills. And so while they want it, they want those face-to-face connections and those interpersonal connections, they just sometimes don't feel like they have the capability of doing it well.
So would you think that there is some kind of failure of the family or the parenting in that somewhere, or is it just the trend of the time?
Yeah, I don't think it has to do with the family. It's really the trend of the time. You know, like I mentioned, schools, just the shift in schools. I mean, kids spend most of their waking hours in school. And so when they're not interacting with other kids, I mean, even as something as simple, and it's hard to like think about this for a second, even as something as simple as the amount of times kids have between classes in high school to transition from one class to another. It used to be 5 or 6 minutes. Kids would go to their lockers, they'd hang out, they'd talk to each other, and then they'd go to class. Now it's like 3 minutes because they don't want any shenanigans happening between classes. You take away those very, very tiny things, those little shifts. And then you compound that over the course of a child's entire educational life history. And you have a situation where those things matter. So it's less about the family dynamics and it's more about just where are they spending time and where are they not spending time.
Do you, when you are talking to your research, I would believe that you would be talking to educationists and people who are making these policies. Do you think it's even registering that this is the impact that's sort of being felt across the generations, and it's only going to get worse if you think of it, because these are only becoming more pronounced, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing is probably in the last 5-7 years we've seen educational institutions sort of shift back a little bit with some of these things. You know, you saw in the early 2000s, we had a real push for STEM education, right? The science and technology, great stuff, right? But sometimes what was happening is it was taking the place of art classes, music classes, things where kids just got to interact versus just sort of listen and be taught something. But then you saw the shift where that went from STEM to STEAM, where they added art back in. So we are seeing some kind of correction. I think there was like, you know, a move to one side and we're kind of coming back to the middle with some other things. But yeah, so I do see that. And I do see that this next generation, Generation Alpha, who are kind of our younger kids right now, are benefiting from some of those things. But we have to just do a much more concerted effort to make sure that kids are getting those skills when they're younger, because when they're older, they get to the workplace and we're like, why don't you know how to work in a group? Well, they just never did, right? Like, and so I think that what's happening is these schools are taking it to heart. Some of them, at least the ones I've been talking to, are really interested in making sure that we kind of, you know, kind of come back to center a little bit more with those kinds of policies and practices.
Right. What are the other highlights that you can share from the study? And did you see any change between the 2014 study and the one that you did post COVID?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. So, you know, some of the things that we found on the study were not, in some ways, not surprising based on just what we had seen anecdotally, right? This values purpose-driven generation, relatively tech savvy with some things, right? Mm-hmm. They could, you know, they could get on some very complex tech platform and do something, but then they can't send an email attachment, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were seeing stuff like that. We had an idea about the interpersonal communication. That was a factor we kind of saw that was going to come up. What was interesting, though, pre-COVID and post-COVID, there was only really one factor that had a significant change, and that was their desire for intrapersonal learning. So pre-COVID, this was a very DIY generation. If they wanted to know something, they would get online. They would look it up. They'd often watch a video, a tutorial. They taught themselves a lot of information. They didn't wait to go to a class or a seminar or something. They just did it right now. It was like part of that was that immediacy, but also part of it was the accessibility of that information. And they liked the interpersonal learning. After COVID, they were a little bit less inclined to want to do that, although they still do. And a lot of them are now, you know, they're using, you know, YouTube, and they're on TikTok watching videos, not just entertainment, but instructional videos. You know, they're going to places like, you know, Duolingo and teaching, you know, learning how to use, you know, do foreign languages. But they're also in like AI, like asking it questions to learn about themselves and learn about other topics. So they're using that, but they're less interested in that than they are in the interpersonal group learning. And that happened after COVID. Again, totally not surprising when you're absent of it for a year or two in their education. But now they're craving some of that group development, that group learning. And so we see a little bit more of a balance with that.
Right, right. You see, this generation is now sort of coming into the workforce as we and over the next few years, some of them will get into leadership mode. What kind of changes do you think that's going to make to business in general and more so this in-person industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting is that if you go back to the heart of who this generation is, they're very, like I said, values and purpose driven. So they often don't engage in educational pursuits, hobbies, interests, and even jobs that they are not fully passionate about. They get they have a short term span on that. That passion is what fuels them to stick with things and to go, you know, to see them through. And so you think about it, you have to have a really good return on investment. So whatever you're asking them to do, whether that's in person or virtual or whatever, it has to have some kind of a very, very tangible tactical return on investment. What am I getting for this? I'll give you a perfect example about live events. You know, some of the feedback we've gotten is, why would I spend a lot of money to go to a conference to see this really great keynote speaker when I'm likely going to have to sit in the very far back? I can't see them. And it's going to be super crowded when I can just sit at home and watch their TED talk or watch them on a YouTube video. And to me, that's, oh my goodness, wait, but being live is the cool part, right? Like going to a concert, right? It's not about the content, it's about the experience. And so we have to sell them the experience, right? Because that, the return on an investment isn't that you're going to learn new information from the speaker. They can get that already. If you would have told me that 25 years ago, that would have been the only way I could have gotten it because the internet wasn't really, you know, a thing. And so, but now that's not the selling point, is that you're going to hear from this great expert. It's the selling point is that you're going to have an experience that you cannot replicate in your room on your device. And so that's where the return on investment and that values piece really has to be at the heart of all of our messaging and what we're doing.
Yeah, that's interesting because it sort of links back in my head when COVID was sort of unending in a mode, like we didn't know when this was going to end. You had the rise of a lot of virtual event platforms, right? Some became really big and big valuation and all that. But that's not the point. Point is that they were trying to sort of replicate your real events and things that you did there. For instance, you could meet people through a speed dating kind of model, right? They'll sort of match and you'll talk to strangers you have not met, which is good. However, what we were trying to do was to replicate what you could do live online, but it didn't take a minute to go back to the live bit because obviously the approach of trying to replicate live to virtual was possibly misplaced. What we should have thought is reimagine virtual. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Right. Yes. I mean, that's the same argument we have for teaching, is if you try to do exactly what you were doing in person and you just put it online, it doesn't hit the same way. Online is its own modality, and you have to be able to do something really interactive and really, really cool online that you can't do in person to make it unique. And I think that in some cases, some people did that well, but I think others missed the boat. I mean, there's some really cool interactivity pieces that you can do online that you can't do potentially in person, at least the same way. That wasn't really as capitalized on. Some people did. They might do like a Zoom event and then put a poll up. But other than that, you know, I think that there's some missed opportunity. And so then it gave these online events sort of a, you know, a second, like a backseat to the live events. Well, I guess you could do it, you know, virtually. And that's kind of, you know, that's your, you know, not ideal. When in reality, the virtual option could be a really cool thing if it was really looked into doing it in such a unique way, which I'm not sure anybody's figured it out. And I don't have the answers, but I just know that what you're saying is it's exactly the same. You can't just pick up a live event and put it on Zoom or put it on a platform and expect it to all of a sudden just be the same as it was live.
Do you think there are lessons? Because one place where I see the Gen Z active together, you are in a better position to define whether I'm right on this or not, is when they're playing multiplayer games. And that's content and activity with multiple people. Lot of them are sort of coordinated stuff, which means they're working in a group and so on. But we have not been able to sort of take it out of the gaming world and bring it into anything else.
Yep. I mean, yeah, it's exactly spot on. There's so many really, really innovative things happening in the gaming world. I mean, even in gaming where you can log on and you can be a part of people gaming against each other, you're not watching it. You're literally a part of just also the spectatorship, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of neat things that are happening in that space. And I think that event planning could have a lot, could learn a lot from that model. I don't know how it would translate, but that's why there's real brilliant people in this field. But yes, absolutely. And what's interesting is I remember a story of a Gen Zer that I knew one time who had been gaming, and his avatar had met somebody else's, and they heard each other's voices and they knew each other's names. That was about it. But they would game every night. Come to find out, he went in to get a coffee, and the guy serving him, they kind of like looked at each other, and they said, "Your voice sounds familiar." And he said, "Yeah, do you game?" And they said, "Yeah." And they figured out they were the two guys that game together all the time. And they were really excited. They were local. They didn't even realize it. And when the Gen Zer came back to tell me that story, I said, "Well, great. Did you exchange contact information? Are you going to go hang out in real life?" He said, "Oh, no, why would I do that?" Right. I just know him in the gaming world. So the gaming world was more powerful to him, that connection, than the live world was. And so think about that. Right. We always see this sort of modality of online as being, again, the second, you know, backseat kind of thing, when in reality, it can be so powerful that he didn't want to lose that connection that he had created in the virtual world.
Right. I mean, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So if we sort of try to understand as where we are missing in our interpretation of Gen Z, what would that be? And obviously we can talk about the trade show events industry in some reference, but basically as non-Gen Zers or the parents of the Gen Zs, what is it that we are missing that we should be focused on?
Well, I mean, the first big one is this idea that we just see them on the very surface. And I think let me give you a couple examples. So as I mentioned before, technology, right? Seeing them, that they don't want to connect with us. This assumption that they don't want to connect because they're on their devices. A lot of them are on their devices because they don't know how to connect with us. But another piece that's really interesting is this idea of, you know, kind of mental health and wellness. We are really missing this. Gen Z is like the canary in the coal mine for all of us when it comes to mental health. They're the ones saying, "I don't want to work in a toxic work environment." And then they quit. And we say, "Oh, they can't hack it. They don't have, they're real thin skinned. They can't," you know, whatever the case may be, whatever it is. And we sort of say, we have all sorts of names for them for that. And you know, because our history, right? We have gone through a lot. Many of us have been in horrible workplaces. We've persevered through terrible things. We've had, you know, really our mental well-being and emotional well-being just taxed to the hilt in organizations. And we kind of think that it's their turn. Like everybody should have to go through that. That's part of the, you know, the career life cycle, when in reality, it's absolutely unhealthy. And they're saying, like, I'm not putting up with this, is really allowing other people who are in older generations to say, I'm not putting up with it either, and drawing some boundaries. We're seeing people who, you know, the whole movement that we had in the last few years of things like quiet quitting, or, you know, when they were just, you know, leaving their workplaces or whatever they were doing, other generations are catching on and saying, wait a minute, you know, I could either sort of poke fun at Gen Z and how they're not very tough or resilient, or I could say, you know what, I don't want to go through that anymore either. And I'm 48 or whatever it might be. And so I think some of the things that we need to do is pay better attention. They're bringing some things to the forefront that we really need to look at. And I'm not saying there's not, you know, downsides to this generation. Every generation has sort of their, you know, kind of overarching flaws. I mean, each individual is different, but the cohort itself. But I do think that they are the canary in the coal mine for a few things. They're really topsy-turvying some ideas around politics. They're really, they're more activist than any generation since the baby boomers. There's just some things that we need to look at. They're not behaving in a vacuum. They're behaving in response to their environments. And what are the environments that they're living in? They're ones that we, most of us who are older people, have cultivated and created in some way. So I think it's just a really important thing that to not miss that, because it's easy to just, again, you know, blame them for something, or, you know, they're difficult to work with in the workplace. Yeah, that may be true, but for some of them, but why, right? And I think that's the bigger question, is we have to ask ourselves, why are they behaving the way that they're behaving when they do? And can we learn something from that? Because I think that we could all be better served if we paid a little more attention.
And that's also sort of, in some ways, contrary to the idea that they don't want to connect. Because if they're thinking about the society, they're connecting differently. That's the mm-hmm. least, that's what I make of it. For them, like your example, that, oh, why would I want to meet him and hang out with him when I can play? I mean, we play right. games. I mean, it's difficult to sort of understand that, right? So the reaction that, would you not like to make him a buddy and meet him often and that's what you would like to do? Well, no, I mean, don't want to do that. I want to do what I do. So right. I mean, it's difficult to understand, actually, this mindset, right? And it sort of doesn't fit into any of the boxes that we are familiar with.
Yep, exactly.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
Okay, I was just hoping that they go pick up trash or something for 10 hours, but she was literally running an organization, a nonprofit organization that she started in high school. And it made me really think about this idea that, you know, their activism looks in some ways similar to what might be familiar to us. You know, they do protests and they've done walkouts, particularly around climate change walkouts. They've done a bunch of different, you know, kinds of more on the surface activism mm-hmm. where we can see, but they do a lot of behind the scenes stuff where they're creating organizations, they're doing social entrepreneurship, businesses that are, you know, addressing a social issue. They're inventing things.
You are listening to a Bizcast Audio Original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for the Trade Show podcast and founder of PitchLink, the visitor engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode. Let's talk a bit about the activism, because that's the story with which you start your TED talk, and it's fascinating about you offering some credits for going and working for the NGO, right?
Yes.
Would you like to recount that?
Yes. It was, I had been teaching an introduction to leadership class for many, many years at a particular university. And we had a requirement that students did 10 hours of volunteer work during the course of the semester as part of their requirement for the course. And I mentioned it. This was the first year that Gen Z was coming into college. And I mentioned in front of the group, you know, you have to do 10 hours of community service. And this one first-year student raised her hand, and she said, can I count the hours that I do running my own nonprofit organization? And I thought, okay, I was just hoping that they go pick up trash or something for 10 hours. But she was literally running an organization, a nonprofit organization that she started in high school. And it made me really think about this idea that, you know, their activism looks in some ways similar to what might be familiar to us. You know, they do protests and they've done walkouts, particularly around climate change walkouts. They've done a bunch of different, you know, kinds of more on the surface activism mm-hmm. where we can see, but they do a lot of behind the scenes stuff where they're creating organizations. They're doing social entrepreneurship, businesses that are, you know, addressing a social issue. They're inventing things. These are all forms of activism that, you know, we might not have thought about because the purpose in which they're doing those is different than maybe a typical inventor. An inventor might invent something, it's a great idea, they sell it or they profit from it and, you know, and they spread it. But this is more like social invention, right? Where they're creating an invention to solve a social issue because in some ways they've been a voiceless entity. Most of them at this point in time were children. They couldn't vote. They didn't have a say in the political process. So to be able to change policies or do anything on the larger scale was not possible. So at 14, 15 years old, they're just inventing things to change the world around them. And so their activism has always kind of come from this innovation, right? An innovative mindset, and sometimes very much behind the scenes, not for fame or fortune. And it's, so it's been fun to watch that unfold over the last more than decade with this generation because they're out doing amazing things. And really a lot of them aren't in the spotlight. They're not trying to like, you know, get this fame and, you know, cover of Time magazine. They're just out there because they want to, you know, cure a disease. They want to, you know, solve a social problem.
Yeah. And, Their awareness and their thought process is also not super local, right? So they're not afraid to, like climate change, they're not afraid to take on things where mostly if you rationally think, your walkout or your protest or your whatever is likely to have no effect at all.
Right.
But that's not stopping them from doing it. Or raising their voice or bringing attention to it. That's also very unique.
Well, yeah, and part of that is that they're also much more globally connected than any other generation has been. So when you look at some of these walkouts, right, like you looked at the climate walkouts, you know, from a few years ago, where they were coordinating with schools all over the world to walk out on the same day, to have a much larger statement, right, of activism versus just one school having a walkout. This happened in 2020 with Black Lives Matter. There were Black Lives Matter marches and protests all over the world, even in places where there just wasn't a prominence of Black people. Just out of solidarity, these youth came together. They used social media. Things went viral. They were able to coordinate. So it's also very interesting to see how they're leveraging activism by using their global connections.
So coming back to trade shows, because that's what we are here to talk about. I think this is all very relevant because I think if you are not paying attention to these things, just like if you are not paying attention to sustainability, it doesn't matter which industry you are in. If you're not having those conversations, then something is likely to go out of control very, very soon, right?
Right.
So as you sort of focus from your work, you have been working on this for more than a decade. You have written books, you have done research. If you project, say 10 years from today, when a lot of these Gen Zers are likely to lead companies or lead organizations that matter and so on, what are we looking at really?
Well, I think it's interesting because their view of leadership is a little bit different than other generations' view of leadership. So if they embody what they look for, which is really purpose-driven, inspirational kind of leadership where everyone is involved in the process of creating whatever change is happening, you're probably going to see them be quite empowering, tend to mental health a lot. You're probably going to see them have very, very forward purpose, a lot of social entrepreneurship, I would gather, where you're seeing that the business is for a social cause. A lot of them are not real happy with the economic, you know, the landscape right now and in their upbringing. Some of them were even little kids when the recession happened, right? So their view of economics is just that there isn't a safety net, that, you know, we have to create something to help the larger situation of, you know, inaccessible housing and education and healthcare. So you'd venture to see that they're going to go into more, you know, like I said, social entrepreneurship endeavors to solve these much larger problems by the work that they do. So they're running their organizations with a very strong purpose in mind that has a bigger impact on a larger society, and then turn around and be able to hopefully embrace that within their organizations by tending to people's well-being, empowerment, advancement, keeping good people. That's what they're looking for. So hopefully that's what they embody. Now, we know that sometimes when you get into a position and you realize you can't do all those things, it changes. But at least ideally, that's what they're looking for. And hopefully that's what they end up doing.
Yeah. If the listeners want to actually track what's going on with Gen Z, and they want to stay in touch with this developing story, as they say, what would you suggest they do? I mean, both leaders who are starting to employ Gen Zs, parents, societies, schools. When I say schools, I mean universities and colleges. So what would you say would be the resources they should be tracking so that they have some clarity about what's really going on?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question, because there's, generational work and studies, and I guess even chatter is very trendy. So if you get online and you look up, you know, Generation Z, you're going to find a lot of stuff in there. You're going to find most of it is going to be people's personal experiences and rants. They're going to have blogs. They're going to have all sorts of things that aren't really grounded in any kind of research. So that's kind of not the best strategy for keeping up with them. And I start with that because I think it's important to know where to go and where not to go. You can't go wrong looking up people who have written books on Generation Z. I know I've written several of them with my co-author, Dr. Megan Grace. There are several other authors out there that have done some work in this, and reading their books and their ongoing studies are really important. Also keeping up on research that's released by very reputable organizations. We use a lot of data from Pew and Census. We'll see YouGov is a great source. They are constantly on the pulse of what's happening. And I'm constantly getting news feeds about those things. So I like to read from the original source rather than someone who's done an op-ed or a blog on it, but to really say, okay, here's what's going on. That's really where I find my information. It's hard in this landscape of trying to do kind of legitimate, rigorous research on this generation and be out there talking about what we're finding, when other people can just in a trendy way put up some kind of fancy web page and say, oh, here's what I think, because I had one employee who was Gen Z. And it makes it really difficult to kind of create that credibility. But as a consumer, you want to make sure that you're looking at that, you're reading it. And as you mentioned before, you know, while we're not talking directly about, you know, trade shows for this entire conversation, it's important to understand the mentality of what's happening with this young group of people, because their motivations to maybe go to school are going to affect their motivations to go to an event or to work in an event planning industry, right? You're going to start to see that these things transcend. If you start looking at social media patterns of Gen Zers and you think that's not relevant, I'm not going to ever message them on social media. No, but you can understand what they're doing on social media translates to how they interact in other areas of their lives. So it's important as a consumer to say, I'm going to look at all this research and then I'm going to try to figure out how this might affect, you know, Gen Zers who are, you know, I'm somehow interacting with, whether I'm working with them or they're a customer or whatever the case may be. That's the really key piece, is that translation piece. And so that's where I think that I would suggest your listeners go.
Yeah, and I think as you rightly suggested, to follow someone like you who is actually going through it. I mean, you're right. I mean, in digital media, everybody's an expert, right?
Right.
And by the way, this is not a news story. We saw that play out during when we were debating whether tobacco was good or bad for us. We know there were many people posing as experts who are nothing but lobbyists, right? So, I mean, we understand. I mean, we understand that playbook. But I think you are right. And if it is possible for you to share links like to your site and others, I'd be happy to carry them as a part of the show notes.
Absolutely.
What kind of, you mentioned already that you have to design experiences for them, and it's not just enough to put up a list of keynotes and so on. What else do you think would be relevant for trade show organizers or exhibitors to think of when they're thinking of Gen Z, especially if they're their direct target customers?
Well, I think one of the things that we have learned, and actually we learned this from our more recent study on generations in the workplace, and we asked them why they do and do not go to events or conferences, professional development experiences, and so forth, which could really translate to what you're talking about. And one of the biggest reasons was, I don't have anyone to go with. Mm. And then when I get there, I won't know anyone. So we can't control on the, as an event planner, you can't control whether or not they have someone to come with. That's like on their end. But what you can do is perhaps work some things into the program that allow them to have some very structured meeting opportunities to connect with others, mentoring programs, new orientations, but not just saying, here's a new orientation, new member orientation, here's some food, but having like, okay, everybody, we have a full program. I want you to turn to the person next to you and answer this question. Like that, you have to have very, very structured activities mm-hmm. because they're nervous about these things. And they're so nervous that they don't even want to come and or they want to stand in the back and be on their phones because of, you know, the kind of the anxiety that it provokes in them. So finding ways to put that into a program. So even if you just, you know, have a booth or something, is what can you do to find connection or create connection at your booth rather than just give information? Because, you know, how do you build that? And again, I don't have the answer. Everybody's going to be have approach it differently. But the idea is that they are craving this connection and they want to come and have this experience that they cannot have otherwise. Coming somewhere to get information that they can get online is not an ROI for them. They want to be able to connect. So I think that that's one of the biggest pieces, is finding a way to make these, even these live sessions, incredibly interactive for them so that they feel like they leave there. It might sound kind of silly, but they leave with friends. They leave with new friends. Hmm. And that experience was transformative for their personhood versus just, I got a lot of great information about my industry.
Right. And obviously that's something the organizers are in a very good position to do. If I may just press on a little further and say, what can an individual exhibitor who is exhibiting do to do the same thing? I mean, is it at all possible, or is it something we need to sort of depend or imagine that the organizers need to be the real protagonist in this?
I think it depends on what the exhibitor is exhibiting, right? Some people have those, you know, games, you spin the wheel and you get people to come over. But what do you do besides that? Because that's still transactional. Is there a way to get people connected? Is there a way to say, come inside the booth and talk to somebody? Is there, I don't have all the answers to that, but I do think that the problem that we've had is that we haven't asked the question. What can we do to make this experience more interactive and connective mm-hmm. for people? And that's a question that I think that exhibitors, event planners need to sit with, because it might look very different from booth to booth or event to event or program to program. But I think that question is really, really key. But it has to be something more than giving away a pen or a keychain. Mm-hmm. And you know, it really just does. And they need to feel like that was a connective experience.
Yeah, this is wonderful. I know I didn't ask many questions, and as I admitted in the beginning, I'm nowhere near well educated about this. Would you like to talk about anything else in this context which I didn't even broach, didn't even come near?
Well, I think there's one other area that's really important, I think, for people who are in this event industry is, you know, we've talked about what would the experience look like, right? Mm-hmm. The external experience, like someone coming in, a Gen Z, or coming in, what could they expect? And talking about the desire for that. There's also the internal process that I think is really important in terms of what Gen Zers are looking for. You know, we're talking about a generation that is highly attuned to environmental issues, not just climate change, but they're attuned to, you know, the lack of biodiversity and the, you know, recycling, pollution, the whole thing, right? They're very interested in that. Sustainability initiatives. What is the event doing to promote sustainability? You know, thankfully we've moved away from like a lot of things like, you know, printed conference booklets or bags or things, but we're still giving away items at, you know, relatively disposable items at booths that they're just going to go home and toss into, and it'll end up in a landfill. Like, what kind of messaging are we sending? And so sometimes we have the overt message, which is like the actual program. What are we going to do? But the little things we do could really undermine that, right? You might have this really great booth and then you give away a bunch of things that, you know, were produced with maybe questionable labor practices and then end up giving them to a Gen Zer who tosses them in a landfill. So like we have to really think about that. This is a generation focused on an environment. They're focused on human rights. They're very big into human rights. What are those kinds of practices that you're demonstrating or role modeling for those Gen Zers so that they feel confident in coming not only like over to your booth or to your program, but they're confident in following up and using your services or connecting with your industry?
Oh, that's so powerful. I think from the conversations I've had, I think sustainability has sort of crept into the conversation, but I don't think human rights is anywhere near the conversation right now.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know that Maritz and David has been very passionate about it, and I'm sure you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a lot of work, but I'm saying that these are topics of in the news studios, or these are topics that get discussed in salons and conferences which are about these topics itself. So connecting it back to brands, or connecting it back to services, or connecting it back to trade shows is something which is not done. I was trying to say rarely mm-hmm. done, but I think it is not done. And I think that's a very, very, very powerful message for those who are looking at Gen Z.
PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high quality engagement between buyers and sellers. Through its presentation and discussion modules, sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement process. PitchLink requires no installation or download, contains and manages the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without interruption. Connect with us on LinkedIn or visit tradeshowengage.com. That is tradeshowengage.com.
Dr. Corey C. Miller, thank you so much for coming to my show and for talking to us. And I'm looking forward to your new book. We have to talk about that.
Absolutely. Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful. Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes featuring great conversations on engaging your booth visitors and maximizing your ROI from your trade show investments. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being with us today on the Trade Show Podcast, the podcast of record for the trade show and events industry. Here we talk to movers and shakers of the $50 billion trade show industry and identify ideas, challenges, tactics, and strategies to leverage the first-party intent inherent in the trade show business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and implement some of the ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of the Trade Show Podcast. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platform like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This is a BizCast original podcast and is produced for PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.